Let's turn to 2 Samuel chapter 18. 2 Samuel chapter 18. Now, you remember David's son Absalom has gone into a state of rebellion against his dad, the king, and has, just gathered a mass of people to himself. And you remember how he kind of had done that. And it was certainly something that was would not be pleasing to the Lord. It was very divisive and destructive and divided the kingdom up and has caused nothing but problems. It's a very destructive end result, this rebellion that he went on. And we'll find that ultimately for him, it ends up being a very destructive thing. You know, the thing is, though, too, is David is also seen, and we see him as he's portrayed in this situation, as exactly the circumstance that it is. He really, in certain ways, was around and stuff, but very disconnected from his kids. And so that's an unfortunate thing, you know, and I think we see a big, you know, there's a huge plague of that in our world today. They're physically there, but they're very disconnected, you know, from really what's happening with their young people. And the end result of it is ultimately David just, because he was disconnected, his kids ended up disconnected from him, and ultimately it just turned into this rebellion, and it's just a horrible, horrible end result. But verse 1 of chapter 18 says, "And David numbered the people who were with him." And you remember David had gone out, you remember they kind of, he'd gotten the council that was kind of defeated, the poor council that was given. And by Ahithophel, you remember, and how he had given this one idea of how to go about it. And the other guy said, no, let's not do that. This is what we ought to do. And so it bought David some time. And so now he's kind of got some things together. And remember, David is a seasoned guy of war. This guy knows exactly how to, and the people with him are like that. They know how to deal with battle, and they're seasoned fighters and stuff. And so Absalom's people are just, you know, just some more of the regular folk, and there might be a few people with them that know what's going on, but it's not like David's guys. And David numbered the people who were with him and set captains of thousands and captains of hundreds over them. And then David sent out one-third of the people under the hand of Joab, and one-third under the hand of Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, Joab's brother, and one-third under the hand of Ittai, the Gittite. And the king said to the people, I will surely go out with you myself. But the people answered, "You shall not go out, for if we flee away, they will not care about us. Nor if half of us die, will they care about us. But you are worth 10,000 of us, for you are now more help to us in the city." So now we can look at this a few different ways. It could be that they're just kind of saying, "Hey, look at, you know, you're getting older. We don't want you out here with us." Could be that. But I think also the reality is he is the object of the issue between Absalom, and it's between him and his dad. That's really the object of the issue. And so they're just saying, "Hey, look at, you know, it's all about him getting to you. And so we want to put a barrier there between you. You stay here, and we're going to go out and deal with this because, you know, the value of him as a king and as a leader and so on." They're just saying, "This is our role. We want to do this. You stay here." Notice how he takes the three and divides it out, takes the three, you know, groups, and that's part of the thing. You know, it's divide to conquer. You know, it's a common battle tactic that they used. And so, again, it just shows the seasonedness of David versus Absalom. I like it, like verse 4 a lot. It says, "Then the king said to them, 'Whatever seems best to you, I will do.'" He says, "You know, I'm with you on this." "So the king stood beside the gate, and all the people went out by hundreds and by thousands." And those of you who have read K.P. Yohanan's book, Touching Godliness with Submission, will understand this concept much better. Again, if you've read that as a textbook, you've grossly made an error. It's not a textbook. This is a book that you should read slowly and let it seep into your being, because it's a very, very important concept, the submission. Because submission, you know, without having submission, it's, and we see David here being submitted as the king to their concept or their idea or their approach, which was a good idea. And he saw that, and he saw the value of that, and he listened, and he said, yeah, that makes sense. It doesn't make him a weak leader. Any good, effective leader is a person, a man, or a woman under submission, under authority. It's interesting that Jesus commended the centurion and his faith, but it was because he understood the concept of submission. That was what it was the highest commendation that Jesus really ever gave was that of the centurion. And he had told him, hey man, you know, you get it. Because remember what he said? He said, I tell someone and they go and they do this. And he knew, he made that connection that, man, Jesus is an authority. And he can tell, you know, in the spirit realm, someone, you know, a messenger to go and touch and heal and do whatever. He understood that deep a concept of authority and submission and the yielding of it. And so it's important. And it's easy, you know, words flow easy, but the reality is, you know, the best way to tell if you really have a servant's heart is how you act when someone treats you like a servant. You know, that because that's a little bit of a challenge sometimes. And so the idea here is David, man, just was so yielded in a good way, and I think it's just a great example to us. Now the king had commanded Joab, Abishai, and Ittai, saying, deal gently for my sake with the young man Absalom. And all the people heard when the king gave all the captain's orders concerning Absalom. So, key thought, hey, that's his wish. That's his desire. Hey, deal kindly with the guy, you know? That's the king's heart. That's his desire. But we got to read on. So the people went out into the field of battle against Israel. And the battle was in the woods of Ephraim. The people of Israel were overthrown there before the servants of David, and a great slaughter of 20,000 took place there that day. For the battle there was scattered over the face of the whole countryside, and the woods devoured more people that day than the sword devoured. So this is the idea. They're, you know, running through the woods or riding through the woods, or, you know, and they're just getting, they're either turning on each other by mistake, they're ambushing each other by mistake, or just the woods themselves. If you're riding on a critter of any sort, a donkey or horse or anything, and you get hit a branch in the wrong spot, you know, you can get killed or knocked off, or, you know, all these things can happen. And so this is really what he's saying. It was just difficult warfare. Again, David's men were very seasoned men of war. They knew how to fight in battle. They knew even difficult areas and how to deal with it. Then Absalom met the servants of David, and Absalom rode on a mule. The mule went under the thick boughs of a great terebinth tree, and his head caught in the terebinth tree, so that it was left hanging between heaven and earth. And the mule, which was under him, went on. So basically, you know, Josephus tells us in his accounting of the history of things. He says, no, actually, because he had such a, remember we read, he was very pleased with his hair. He was very proud of his hair. And he would cut it once a year and sold it for X number of dollars. And, you know, but he was riding under and he big head of hair and he just got caught in the bough of this limb of the tree. And the critter kept going and he just got stuck there. He got stuck hanging there. And then now a certain man saw it and told Joab and said, I just saw Absalom hanging in the terebinth tree. And so Joab said to the man who told him, You just saw him? Why did you not strike him there to the ground? I would have given you 10 shekels of silver and a belt. So that seems good, like a real deal. I don't know about the belt part, but it's a good deal on the silver part. Then a man said to Joab, though I were to receive 1,000 shekels of silver in my hand, I would not raise my hand against the king's son. For in our hearing, the king commanded you and Abishai and Ittai, saying, beware lest anyone touch the young man Absalom. Otherwise, I would have dealt falsely against my own life, for there is nothing hidden from the king, and you yourself would have set yourself against me. And then Joab said, I cannot linger with you. He says, man, I'm just going to go take care of this myself. And he took three spears in his hand and thrust them through Absalom's heart. And while he was still alive in the midst of the terebinth tree, and 10 young men who bore Joab's armor surrounded Absalom and struck him and killed him. So basically thrust him through. While he's dying, the other guys just finished him off. A lot to think about. Ultimately, the end result, you know, of the bitterness that had set in his life, end result of the rebellion that had gotten a hold of his life that he had continued to live under and follow through, led to ultimately his own destruction and his own death. And so Joab blew the trumpet in verse 16, and the people turned from pursuing Israel, for Joab held back the people. And they took Absalom and cast him into a large pit in the woods and laid a very large heap of stones over him. Then all Israel fled, everyone to his own tent. Now Absalom in his lifetime had taken and set up a pillar for himself, which is in the king's valley. For he said, I have no son to keep my name in remembrance. He called the pillar after his own name, and to this day is called Absalom's Monument. Kind of a sad end result that he made his own monument, you know, that he chose, wanted to build something out for himself and build his own monument for himself because he has no other heritage really or anything. He's done nothing that really represents anything great. The other thing that's kind of interesting to think about is this idea of the rebellion that that he was living under. You remember in Deuteronomy, when we'd gone through Deuteronomy in chapter 21, and one of the things that it said was the consequences of rebellion. And it said that the parents were then, if the child, God dealt with this stuff very severely. He said, if this child's in rebellion, you can bring them to the gates of the city. You can have them, the elders go over this, and yes, this kid's in a state of rebellion. Then they take him out and they stone him. They just didn't mess around with it. I mean, they dealt very severely with rebellion. And regardless of our personal thoughts about any of that or whatever, that it was a healthy way of purging out this end result that ends up happening that's so destructive, because he was bent on destruction. This thing that's interesting to me is ultimately this is, look at what happens to him. Really, even though he built for himself what he thought was his own monument, ultimately he's laying there in a pit under a heap of rocks, which is ultimately God's word stands true. It got dealt with. And though I think Joab here, you know, even though he knows David, and he knows that David wouldn't probably follow through with this, what needed to be done. And so Joab did what needed to be done, because Absalom was in this state of rebellion. Irreparable. Horrible, horrible, horrible conclusion. Then Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok, said in verse 19, let me run now and take the news to the king how the Lord has avenged him of his enemies. So Ahimaaz is pretty excited about this whole thing. Ahimaaz is known as a really good runner. This is no joke. I'm serious. This guy's known for he's just a good runner. And so Ahimaaz is pretty excited. Let me run. Let me go take the news to the king. The thing was Ahimaaz didn't really have the whole picture of what was going on as we read on. We find that he really didn't see or know exactly all that was happening. Now, Joab knew that he didn't know all that yet. Joab was aware of that. But Ahimaaz himself wasn't aware that he didn't really have all the information, you know? And so he's just going to run with this information. And Joab said to him, you shall not take the news this day, for you shall take the news another day. But today you shall take no news, because the king's son is dead. And Joab said to the Cushite, go tell the king what you have seen. And the Cushite bowed himself to Joab and ran. So this other guy, he did have, he had seen, he was aware, he knew what was going on, and Joab said, no, you you go, you run with this information and take it and give it to the king. And Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok, said again to Joab, but whatever happens, please let me also run after the Cushites. So Joab said, why will you run, my son, since you have no news ready? You've got nothing to say, really. But whatever happens, he said, let me run. So he said to him, run. Then Ahimaaz ran by the way of the plain, and ultimately he outran the Cushite. He kind of, out there running along, and this guy's just known as he's a really fast, he's a good runner, and he just knows, and he just ends up passing the other guy, and he runs, he gets to the city gate. Then the watchman cried out and told the king, and the king said, if he is alone, there is news in his mouth, and if he came rapidly and drew near. And then the watchman saw another man running, and the watchman called to the gatekeeper and said, there's another man running alone. And the king said, he also brings news. So the watchman said, I think the running of the first is like the running of Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok. See, this guy's known for being a good runner. I mean, somehow they could tell by the way the guy ran. He's just, I don't know, he just maybe had a funny way of running. Some people do, and he just stood out or something. But he's a good man, and he comes with good news. So Ahimaaz called out and said to the king, all is well. And then he bowed down with his face to the earth before the king and said, blessed be the Lord your God, who has delivered up the men who raised their hand against my lord the king. And the king said, is the young man Absalom safe? Ahimaaz answered, when Joab sent the king's servant and me, your servant, I saw a great tumult, but I did not know what it was about. He says, man, I saw something going on, but I'm not really sure about all of what was going on. And he says, the king said to him, turn aside and stand here. And so he turned aside and stood still. Just then the Cushite came, and the Cushite said, there is good news, my lord the king, for the Lord has avenged you this day of all those who rose against you. And the king said to the Cushite, is the young man Absalom safe? So the Cushite answered, may the enemies of the Lord the king and all who rise against you to do harm be like that young man. Basically saying, hey man, he's dead. And the king was deeply moved and went up to the chamber over the gate and wept. And as he went, he said thus, oh, my son Absalom, my son Absalom, if only I had died in your place. Oh, Absalom, my son, my son. So you can see he's obviously heartbroken. This kind of brings up some questions as he weeps and cries in this situation. He's upset about what had happened and how it had happened and all this. But, when we go back and we kind of look back and we say, well, wait a minute, what about what happened when his other son with Bathsheba, when that particular child had died? You remember when that child had died and there was this question, they even questioned and said, hey, how come you're not crying? You're not even upset. You remember, because he wept before the child died, but then he didn't weep after the child died. And there was, it was kind of a question mark. The people even questioned it. And what did he say? David said, the child will never come back to me, but I will see the child again. The child's not coming to me, but I will go to him, basically, is what he said. Remember that? The child died before the age of accountability. And so this concept was that, hey, I'm going to see him in eternity. This is a hopeful, good, exciting, that's a great thing, like brings great hope. But then why in this situation is he weeping? I think this idea or the concept or the reality of the situation being the understanding that, man, Absalom died in a complete state of rebellion. And the reality is David's really probably not going to see him again. He's left. It's this idea of people leaving the earth without the Lord. They can be lovely, wonderful people. They can, but if they're in a state of rebellion against God, they perish, and that's eternal separation from God. Ultimately, if the Bible, we either believe that wholeheartedly to be true, that we believe what Jesus said regarding that, that he's the way, the truth, and the life, and no one comes to the Father but through him, that it is that personal relationship. And I know we believe that as Christians. That's really what the Bible teaches. But it's so important that that's our concept and our view of situations. And I think that was where Absalom's situation broke David's heart so much. Because the reality is he's probably never going to see him again. And there wasn't going to be contact because there was going to be this eternal separation. And that's grievous. That's a horrible thing. But I think it's good to note that and realize, man, how important and how significant this is. Now, I want to spend a few minutes and just, and we'll kind of wrap up our time together in these thoughts. And we've got a few scriptures to read, so it won't be just a couple. It'll be a few more minutes. But I just want to spend a little bit of time on this thought of this idea of the runners. Because the runners are kind of an interesting, they're kind of tucked away here. It's a little bit low profile in a sense. It's not, this big, normally this big story that's developed out of these guys or these two men's lives. But the concept is very, very significant. Because a lot of times the idea is we see those who run quickly. They're zealous and it's good. The zeal they have for God is good. Those things are good. Those are good qualities. Those are good things. But the idea in this is that he ran, but he didn't really have all or enough of the information that he needed. And even Joab told him, no, dude, you don't just know. You don't need to run. Now, it would have been wise for him to just sit still and not then. Because he expended a whole lot of energy, didn't he? And there was an expectation upon his arrival that there was some type of information that was going to be dispensed. There was some kind of hope that there was information. And I think a lot of times it's kind of the idea of getting out ahead of God a little bit, and we can see the life is ultimately going to stand for something. What's really the message that there is in our life? All of us, our lives have some kind of significance and a message and a purpose. And what is that? And that's part of the whole concept that we've been kind of developing in our Sundays, once a month, where we kind of are taking time to listen and hear people share their testimony, their story, that we can start to get in touch with, again, this idea of sharing our story. Again, it's having a message, having something to say of value that's going to impact someone else's life in a positive way. We can run quickly, but if we arrive with nothing to say, nothing of value, it really is somewhat insignificant, isn't it? And so the importance of that is knowing what it is that we're to say. So the other guy wasn't the fastest guy, but what was told to the first one that arrived, that got there the quickest, that, he runs well, he looks good when he's running, and all these things, it's notable. But the king said, turn aside and stand here. This is what ends up happening. Now, if he would have listened to Joab, that would have been what he was doing to begin with. Just do that. Remember, he told him, just wait. Just be still, But the guy had trouble being still. He couldn't just be still. You remember how the Lord told Moses, be still, Be still. And there's another time where he says, hey, it's not time to pray, Moses. It's time to move, dude. There's a time to take action and move, and there's a time to be still and know that I am God. I think either way, we're going to know that he's God. When he says go, we're going to know that he's God in the go. And when he says be still, we're going to know that he's God when we're still. It's important that we're hearing the instructions from the Lord and what really is the direction of our lives. There's a couple of scriptures that I think are kind of worthwhile. The first one is out of Hebrews. Again, these aren't going to be unfamiliar, I don't think, to too many of you, but ones that are significant to this concept in chapter 12 of Hebrews. Verse 1, this idea of running and running with information and running with some direction, running with something that is of value. Therefore, we also, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. So I think out of that, we know we've taught through this before. We've heard good messages on this. We're familiar with this idea. But the concept of being engaged in a race, it's a personal race. You're not necessarily in competition with anybody else. It's not about getting there the fastest. It's not about, you know, do you remember? I know you're going to remember this. Some of you are. You've got you're in grade school. You've got your homework sheet. Everybody got the same little study sheet. You know, it's a worksheet that you're doing. And not even just homework, just a worksheet that you're doing in class. And there was always somebody that seemed to just fill it all in so fast and then turn it in. And, man, I always used to sit there and think, man, I must be just an idiot, you know? I can't even write that fast, much less have accurate answers and stuff. And then you come to find out later, as time goes by through the semester, that they're just scribbling anything in there. They're not really reading the questions. They're not really answering it. Yeah, they got the study sheet done the fastest, but they had no real information on it. Not only did they not have information, they had inaccurate information, you know. It wasn't done correctly. And so I remembered that when I was thinking about this, and I was thinking, gosh, that's just like that. They turn in their stuff, but it's not really, there's no thought, there's nothing really done with it that was accurate or of really substance or value, right? And so each of our lives in the Lord represent substance and value in the Lord. And God wants to use us. I think of Paul, how he went off, as Saul went off into Arabia and spent quite some time, a number of years there, spent with the Lord personally, as the Lord was just tutoring him through only what he had, which was the Old Testament scriptures, and revealing himself to Paul that he might then, as he went out, be able to effectively then communicate and see and unfold the word, you know, and share with his contemporaries and others around him and the world around him. Ultimately, he was to go to the Gentiles. That was his ultimate destination. And he needed all of that information in order to help them see who the one true living God was and is. And so for us, I think there's this, Oswald Chambers in his devotional says the go of preparation. And he goes through and he describes these different types of go. There's the go of preparation, that you need to be prepared. And when you go and when you're doing things, you need to be prepared for what the Lord has in life. So this idea, lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us. So setting aside those things of the life in our past and all those things, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us. So it's not a sprint, right? It's not the fastest. It's a long haul. It's an endurance. And we talk about being patient. Patience builds that endurance. You know, it talks about that building process, getting to where you've built up the endurance. You have to exercise that for that to happen, right? You have to exercise. To build up endurance, there has to be exercise, you know, or else you end up really sore, and this is what happens to me all the time. And the idea, too, is keeping our eyes on Jesus, looking unto Jesus, the author and the finisher of our faith, looking to him, not to other people, not looking around at the people running near you, but looking to the Lord. The Lord is the prize. The Lord is what we're looking to please. The Lord is the finish line. He's the one that we're to keep our eyes fixated upon. You know, as long as Peter had his eyes on Jesus, no matter how big the storm was, it was raging around, he could walk right out to him, as long as he kept his eyes on Jesus. As soon as he looked around and saw that he was out of the boat, and he realized that the storm's raging around him, and he got fixed on the situations and circumstances, eyes off of the Lord, he went down. Fortunately, Jesus is right there, sticks his hand out. Jesus picks him right up and gets him back in the boat, and it's all good. The Lord takes care of him. Let's turn to another scripture out of 1 Corinthians chapter 9. 1 Corinthians chapter 9. Verse 24. Paul here says, "Do you not know that those who run in a race all run, but one receives the prize? Run in such a way that you may obtain it. And everyone who competes for the prize is temperate in all things. Now they do it to obtain a perishable crown, but we for an imperishable crown. Therefore, I run thus, not with uncertainty. Thus I fight, not as one who beats the air, but I discipline my body and bring it into subjection, lest when I have preached to others, I myself should become disqualified." He says this idea in verse 26, "Therefore I run thus, not with uncertainty." There is a determination in it. There's a discipline within it. This is why we're called disciples, you know, learners, an ongoing learning process. But this idea is, it's not aimlessly. It's not aimlessly just going through the motion. I see so much around the nation. I see so much around the world today of all of, you know, so much energy expended at what? Even within Christianity, what really is the objective? What really is the goal? You know, what really are we shooting toward? What are we aiming at? And I think it's important to have that mindset of, what am I aiming at? What is the most important thing in my life? What really is going to matter when it's said and done? That I ran really fast and ran really fast and ran really fast and I turned in all my study sheets really quickly and all this stuff, and you know, but really there was no substance to it. There was nothing of really significance that mattered, nothing of real value. It was just a lot of energy expended. You ever been stuck in the mud with a, you can have the best vehicle in the world, but once you're stuck in the mud, you're stuck in the mud. And you can have the biggest motor, you have a 450 motor in there with a blown engine on it, and you can have that thing floored. But it's just flinging mud. You're going nowhere, right? All the power's there, all the stuff, but you're stuck in the mud. You're not getting anywhere. And so the idea is not to be aimless. So let's think about the word walk when Paul used the word walk. And we've talked about this from time to time, the significance of that word walk. It was different than the idea of some of the words that could have been used. There's walk that means meander. There's walk that means lollygag. There is that walking that I'm just strolling along. I have no real purpose to it. Nothing really going on. I'm just lollygagging. This is sometimes, now even when I'm at Silver Dollar City, I try not to lollygag too much because I'm really trying to either get to the saltwater taffy, or I'm trying to get to a cinnamon roll, or I'm trying to get to the succotash, or I'm trying to get, you know, I've got a purpose and a destination. But you get what I'm saying. Sometimes when you just get into this mode where you just, I think so much of the body of Christ is lollygagging. And Satan is just having a heyday with that. There's this distraction over here. Yeah, I'm going to go look at that. And there's that distraction over there. I'm going to go look at that. No focus. I think it's so high time that we focus in on, as believers, what is the objective? What are we aiming at as Christians? And I think that's very individual, and it's very much a body life thing all at the same time. I think it's for us as individuals to know that. Personally, because we fit into then a body of believers. And so we have this place. This is really why. This has been my heart. And this is the reason we set up and started doing those classes. That's the only reason for it. It's because I really, my desire is to help and to assist believers in understanding that, you know, this, there's a lot of ways a church can function. And so I'm not saying that any one way is just the perfect way or that our way is the perfect way, but we have a way we function. And it's in line with the scripture. And that's the direction we're going. And it hopefully starts to kind of nose in on a direction overall of what the purpose, ultimately, to glorify God. But God really doesn't get glorified in, you know, just haphazard, you know, willy-nilly, just this spastic stuff. Knee-jerk reactions, for example, are just that. You sit on the table, they tap your leg, and it's just a reaction, you know? You kick the doctor, you know, or the nurse, right? It's just, it's a knee-jerk reaction. It's just a tap, we can kick, you know? It's just a reflex. It's something that we do. Well, but I think God's asking of us as his children to follow him. And so there's a direction in our life. It's not a lollygag. If your life's a lollygag, get off of the lollygag trail and get onto the directional flow trail. It's not a perfect thing because we all falter and fail sometimes at it. But it is something that we're going to hit the target a lot more consistently if we're aiming at it, right? And so I read through this and I think, wow, this is so important for us. I mean, Paul talks about this so clearly that I run thus, not with uncertainty, not aimlessly, but with direction and with clarity, with purpose. So this walking is not meandering. It really, the walking that we do as Christians, why it's called a walk, is because it is one that is has direction and flow and consistency and some purpose to it. There's determination in it. This is what then builds up the endurance in the believer's life. There's another scripture in 2 Timothy. It kind of wraps up some of this kind of a thought, I think, in an interesting way. For Paul here says in chapter 4 of 2 Timothy, verse 6, "For I am already being poured out." This is the end of his life. He says, "For I am already being poured out as a drink offering, and the time of my departure is at hand." Says in verse 7, chapter 4, "I have fought the good fight. I have finished the race. I have kept the faith. Finally, there is laid up for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will give to me on that day, and not to me only, but also to all who have loved his appearing." He's finished the race that was set before him. I fear that many people don't even know that they're in a race, that they're engaged in a race. My concern is that many, if they're in the race, have lost sight of the prize, of what we're aiming at. And I am concerned that ultimately, really, there's just a complete disconnect from what really is going on in this life here, you know, this life we have. And I really found, I look at these guys as they were the two runners, and they just kind of represent, you know, there's this one, you know, one guy. They're running the same path even. Think about it. They're even running on the same path. They both get somewhere, but they one has something, some valid information, and one has absolutely nothing to say, really, of any value. What a horrible thought to think that that would be the case. So I guess really the question is, for us as individuals and for us to gravitate toward, and again, this is one of the reasons as of the last, it took a couple of years to get it put together, and we started running through some of it last year, and now it's, you know, running in a cycle where people can participate in it. But that's my heart. It's not to make, you know, a bunch of more things to do, but it's so that people that come and consider this church home can see, okay, this is the direction that we're going. This is what's going on. And I just picked four key areas that I thought were most significant. One is just, you know, a familiarity with the church here and basic church government, because I think those things matter in our world today of how we do things, because it's a question that I hear a lot, and why not answer that? And the other reality is for those of you who've taken this, especially the first class, what's interesting is what it starts off with this. We know, and you need to know that we know, that we all come to situations as we assemble together with baggage. And our asking is, hey, let's check our baggage with the Lord. Let's leave it there. And let's let God do something new in our lives. And because we're kind of on this journey together, we're embarking on this journey together that we call doing church, or we call, you know, a gathering or a fellowship of believers or whatever. But we're embarked on a journey because God's always moving. God's always on the go. And that's why we started with that. So there was a concept of that. And then, you know, the next thing is once you become somewhat familiar with that, now we go into this idea of you know, reaching other people, sharing our faith, sharing the story of who God is in our life. And we just, some simple ideas, some simple concepts of what's significant about that, how that can be beneficial. Then it goes on into the next class where you kind of learn about the spiritual gifts and just some ideas that everyone is endowed with specific, certain, unique spiritual gifting. And it's a wonderful thing. Everyone has got spiritual gifting. And we all fit in a specific place. And if we fit in that place and are doing that, then it makes a body very effective, a church very effective. And then, but it all has to be governed, right, by the Lordship of Jesus Christ. And then the last class that you spend time is, man, serving the Lord in general. We talk about serving the Lord in general wherever you, because I want this to be useful tools in a believer's life wherever they end up ultimately as time goes by. If you move out of the area, you end up at some other church somewhere else, I want you to have benefited being around here with us. That there's, you know, sure, going through the Word together is awesome. That's all great. But there's an effective way to be a part of and connect to and be useful within a body of believers. And so we've got this idea of serving the Lord, not only in our fellowship, yes, ultimately, yes, that's spoken about, but really just serving the Lord. And so we just pick those things because those are things that are good ignition points to just get rolling and get connected and be a part of. Because you know what? When you got skin in the game, it's a different deal. And what I mean by that is when you're invested a little bit in what's going on, it's a different deal. When you're connected and you're serving, you're a part of that, man, there's just a different connection to it. And so it's exciting. It becomes fun. It's not just something I go and do. It's something I'm a part of. I'm engaged in it. I'm not just on the peripheral edges watching. No, I'm connected to it. I'm a part of it. I'm engaged in it. And that's really part of what this kind of message that I'm talking about is about. Because really the question boils down to is, what is your life's message? What is the message of your life? What does it ultimately represent? What does it stand for? And it's interesting, what do you believe others would say of your life? Because I am, and you are, and we are largely what others would say of us when we're not around. That's unfortunate sometimes. But I am, and you are, and we are, largely what others say we are when we're not around. And so you kind of got to kind of go third person a little bit and say, gosh, Lord, I wonder, what is it that my life really represents? What's the message of my life? What is that constant undercurrent of my life? What does my life really represent? Great challenge in this. I'm just going to read this one to you, but it's a great, great challenge to think about. I will stand my watch and set myself on the rampart, and I will watch to see what he will say to me and what I will answer when I am corrected. The Lord answered me and said, write the vision and make it plain on tablets, that he may run who reads it. For the vision is yet for an appointed time, but at the end it will speak, and it will not lie. Though it tarries, wait for it, because it will surely come. It will not tarry. Ultimately, God's purpose will be fulfilled if we will take a moment, if we will take a few moments, and we will from time to time step back and assess and say, Lord, am I aiming at the right things? What is the message
that my life is saying to others around me? Think about it. What if the message is said, he or she dutifully does things? Now that's noble, don't you think? I think that's noble, that's good. But is that really the fullness of what you would want the message of your life to say, that they dutifully do things? What if it said, that person seems to really lovingly care and be really committed to those things that are in front of them? I've said almost the same thing. It's a very different tone, isn't it? And the only way that would be seen is Christ within us. I can do a lot of really good things. I can run a race that seems like it's going really well. But I can do it very self-involved. I can do nice tasks for people because it makes me feel better about me. I can serve other people because it makes me feel good to serve other people. Or I can serve my Lord Jesus Christ, keeping my eyes on the prize, and in so doing serve other people. And the focus is very shifted. It's not on me. It's not on my service. It's on the person of Jesus Christ. It's different. You see what I'm saying? It's a different mindset when I actually start to spend a moment alone with God. You have to get alone with God. This is not a husband and wife thing. It can be later after one knows individually and the other knows individually, and then they can come together and talk about it together and say, okay, together, these would be our life goals. I talk to guys that have a burden for ministry, and I tell them, make sure your wife is on the page with you, or else you will be dragging a ball and chain around with you wherever you go and whatever you do, and your life will be miserable, and so will hers, and your kids will be bitter against you for it. Or you can patiently wait and let God do the work in each other's hearts, and therefore God can move. But if you don't, if I don't, if we don't sit still from time to time, get up on the ramparts and just sit and say, God, what is the message for my life? What do you want to do through my life? What is the message that you want to portray through my life? I guarantee you, brothers and sisters, we won't be far off from each other. Little thing here, little thing there, but we won't be far off from each other. If we get alone with the Lord, you know, Ray W. Tozer said in, I won't remember the title of the book now, but that's going to bother me. But in one of his books, he kind of talked about the idea of 1,000 pianos, remember? But tuned to one fork. What was it? The pursuit of God, yes. He said if all 1,000 pianos could be out, but if they're all tuned to the same fork, man, it's going to sound like one piano. I really believe that to be true. I believe that if you and I, if we get alone with God, we're going to hear similar things because it's going to be focused on the Lord. So get alone. Spend some time alone. Hear from the Lord. Say, Lord, man, my life at this point in time, I want it to mean something. I want it to have a message of something. But I don't want it to be my message. I want it to be your message. Then there's a difference, isn't there? You know? Letting him have that place and letting him. So then we're going to run, right? We're going to run the race. We're going to run the race effectively, both individually and as a body of believers. We're not going to be spastic running down, you see, because we're going to run synchronized. You see, that's what does the Lord say? Do all things decently and in order. Because it functions right then, right? And so that's kind of the concept I see in that little portion. The one guy is a great runner. He does well, but he's just got nothing. There's no substance there. He didn't spend time up on the ramparts hearing, knowing, Lord, what have you called? What have you purposed? What do you really want to do in and through my life? What is my life gonna really represent? Well, Absalom's was his own little tower that he built for himself. You know what I think about that. That's sad. Man, we want to be like the Cushite, man, that just wasn't necessarily the fastest dude, but he had the right information, man. He had the information that was going to impact the kingdom.